Amid angry debates in Washington over the debt ceiling and the deficit, what can religious leaders do to help end the deadlock? Plus, the precipitous decline of the once powerful Catholic Church in Ireland.
But I don't think as a force it will ever again, in my lifetime certainly, will never have the power it had when I was a child. And I think that's a good thing.
And in West Africa, finding a way to help people abandon the ancient practice of female circumcision.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. All week, financial experts in and out of Washington warned of the catastrophic consequences if Congress does not raise the country's debt ceiling by August 2nd. After that deadline, the government would not be able to pay all its obligations for the first time in history. Officials warned that that could trigger financial chaos and vast hardship. By week's end, there were signs of a temporary fix to the debt ceiling problem, but no agreement on a long-term deal on spending and taxes, which many had wanted, including the president.
I think it's important for the American people that everybody in this town set politics aside, that everybody in this town sets our individual interests aside, and we try to do some tough stuff.
In the midst of the financial debate, where are the churches? Can religious leaders influence the politicians? Author and activist Reverend Jim Wallace is the editor of Sojourners magazine. His is a leading religious voice in political debate. Jim, welcome.
Thanks, Bob.
There are two big questions that people have been arguing about in this town. One is the debt ceiling.
Right.
The other is long-term. Mm-hmm. The debt ceiling is something that has to be done now, but long-term, how do we bring the country's spending and taxes in line? You've been working very hard lobbying to protect government programs that help the poor. How are you doing?
Well, I think I'm happy with what we've seen so far. We started with a provocative question: what would Jesus cut? That got attention to the question. Then we fasted for almost a month in Lent. That brought more attention to it. Then we formed a circle of protection: Roman Catholic bishops, Salvation Army, National Association of Evangelicals, many people, not the religious left here, almost everyone saying that you can't balance the budget on the backs of the poorest people. And I think that voice is now being heard. We've talked Republicans, Democrats, and the White House right along on this.
You are trying, I think, to get a meeting with a lot of the players in this.
We have been meeting right along.
Yeah. And we're continuing. Well, what do you say to them?
We say, you know, there are principles here, that a budget is a moral document and must be evaluated by those from the bottom up. That's our point of view. And the common good has to outweigh ideological political battles in this town. But we also ask them what their faith means, what if they're people of faith, and many say they are, what their faith means, their moral compass, how they decide things.
You take that argument, what does your faith mean, to Republicans in the House who insist on no compromise?
They're Catholics and evangelicals, Republican side, Democratic side. Yeah, now we don't get involved, Bob, in the which bill we're going to support. We don't lobby for bills. But we say there's principles here. You can't just have the benefits all go to corporations and wealthy people and nothing for those who are most vulnerable.
But the common good, this idea of the common good, very important in religious and ethics. How do you define it? And who says what the common good is?
Well, this week we've organized 5,000 pastors to say, let's look at the real people in our congregations, in our communities, what's going to happen to them, as opposed to the Washington, D.C. question, who's up, who's down, who's going to be the Speaker of the House next time, who win the next election. The common good is about the real people, the people we have to always take into account. And pastors, I think, I want to talk to people whose job it is, they have to reread the Bible, you know, to get them focused on who the real people are here.
But this argument about how to cut spending, what could be cut, how to raise income, This is a very technical, very political argument. How do religious leaders feel about, do you feel that you have the ability to get in and be influential in something as technical as this debate?
You know, the details are technical and not difficult, really. Once you agree to some principles, the details can be worked out by the politicians. You know, we say let justice roll down like waters. Let the politicians work out the plumbing here. You know, we don't get into all the details. We're saying there are principles here. If this is going to focus on targeting poor people, we say that's wrong. It's got to be shared sacrifice here. How you do it, this really isn't rocket science. We could solve this if the principles were clear from the start.
Many thanks to Jim Wallace of Sojourners Magazine.
Thank you, Bob.
In Ireland, the Justice Minister describes as truly scandalous the findings of a new government report on clergy sex abuse, this time in a rural diocese of County Cork. The report shows that complaints against 19 priests were ignored as recently as 2009, 13 years after the Irish Church hierarchy issued guidelines for the protection of children. This is only the latest episode in a long series of events that have altered Irish society and left Ireland's once powerful Catholic Church so weakened, some say it could become irrelevant. Deborah Potter reports.
It's often called the Emerald Isle, and with good reason. Ireland is as green as ever. But the country that once was a bastion of Roman Catholicism has changed. The vast majority of people here still call themselves Catholic, 87% on the most recent census. But many of the most faithful churchgoers in Ireland today aren't even Irish. This Sunday Mass in Limerick is said in Polish for some of the thousands of immigrants who poured in during the economic boom of the past decade. But it's hard to find an Irish congregation this packed, and especially this young, in bigger cities.
People still identify themselves as culturally Catholic, even though they no longer go to Mass or go to confession. You'll see them at First Communions, you'll see them at confirmations, and you see them at funerals. They're taking a very much an a la carte view to the practice of their religion.
As recently as the 1970s, almost 90% of Irish Catholics went to Mass at least once a week. Today, the number is closer to 25%. And in some parts of Dublin, just 2 or 3% of self-described Catholics regularly go to church.
Did you grow up Catholic by chance?
Yes.
Do you go to Mass now?
Not really that much. No, not at all.
Weddings and funerals, things like that, that's basically it.
Those who do go for special occasions like this prayer service in County Galway can't help but notice that the people in the pews have changed.
They're old. That is the main thing. When you look down at a congregation from the altar now, you see mostly grey heads. The young people, the under 40s, have largely deserted the church in Ireland now.
Irish priests are aging too. On average, they're well over 60. Many are still working into their 80s, and replacements have slowed to a trickle. At Maynooth, the country's only Catholic seminary, the number of students being ordained to the priesthood has never been lower.
20 years ago, you could have been certainly over 20, and maybe not that unusual to have a year when they would have been over 30. Now we're much more likely to have somewhere under 10, 6, 7, that kind of thing.
In the Diocese of Dublin, not a single priest will be ordained this year or next year. It's been a stunning decline for a church that once virtually ruled the country.
It was a huge organization. It was like an alternative state within the state. It ran our schools, it ran our orphanages, it ran our reformatories, it ran most of our hospitals. So therefore you can get an idea of the scale of what the Catholic Church, it was an alternative society within Ireland.
The Catholic Church here in Ireland saw its influence begin to wane with the social upheaval of the 1960s. But in the past 20 years, two factors combined to accelerate its decline: sudden prosperity and the shocking revelations of sexual abuse. The worldwide recession stopped the so-called Celtic Tiger in its tracks, but consumerism had already weakened the church's hold on the Irish people, who had become far better educated over the previous 40 years.
They questioned their faith, they questioned the right of bishops to tell them how to live their lives.
The body blow, however, came from the clergy abuse scandals that hit harder and closer to home in Ireland than anywhere else. Here, almost everyone knows someone who's been affected.
Maybe we as older people did a lot of covering up. Also, we were very much into appearances, putting our best foot forward, saying the right things. I think with all the scandals that were revealed, it certainly made people think more and question, a lot of things that were happening.
Those who had a shaky faith now had an excuse for walking, because why would you go to the church every Sunday morning to hear somebody who potentially isn't in league with child abusers? And I think many people used the backlash against child abuse as a basis for saying, do I really want to subscribe? Do I want to contribute? Do I want to be part of that type of a church anymore? I think at the heart of our problem is, in a sense, the church has lost its moral authority. The church has lost its right to speak out on issues.
The abuse was a betrayal of trust, Pope Benedict acknowledged in a pastoral letter last year to Irish Catholics, his first ever apology for the sexual abuse of children by priests. This year, during an extraordinary liturgy of lament and repentance at Dublin's Pro-Cathedral, the Archbishop of Dublin and Boston's Cardinal O'Malley prostrated themselves, asking God and the victims for forgiveness. But it hasn't been enough.
People are still waiting, I think, for the kind of great atonement and the kind of fundamental change that will convince them that things have changed. There isn't enough evidence yet that things have fundamentally changed.
It's a crisis, and it's not one of the future, it's one of right now. And it's quite extraordinary, an organization as big and as ancient as the church, that we cannot face a crisis that's right at our doorsteps and begin to talk realistically about it.
The kind of change Father Flannery advocates would be dramatic.
Opening up the ministry of the church to lay people, to married people, to priests, or to women. In other words, not confining it to the male celibate priesthood as we've had in the past. Because clearly that is not working now, so we have to begin to think in different ways. But the Vatican is increasingly forbidding any discussion on that.
Still, there are small signs of renewal. Some parishes now have lay people in positions that would have been unthinkable a generation ago. Kevin Mullally is a full-time pastoral worker. Sheena Darcy works for the International Eucharistic Congress.
I've seen young people come back to know God's love. I've seen young people get more involved in the church.
They're also searching for basic things, belonging and love and acceptance and tolerance, and all those elements go together in a spirituality.
Yes, there's that acknowledgement that what happened was dreadful. It was absolutely dreadful. However, we do need to move on.
Whatever happens, the Catholic Church in Ireland has already changed irrevocably.
I do believe Catholicism will continue, will survive in Ireland. I do believe the clerical church will not. That doesn't mean there won't be priests, of course there will be, but I don't think as a force it will ever again, in my lifetime certainly, will never have the power it had when I was a child. And I think that's a good thing, because it abused its power massively. It became a dictatorship in a democracy, which was answerable to nobody.
I still have the view that what's happening is actually something quite healthy, because the church we will end up with will be a church of committed, passionate and dedicated people who will live the Gospels rather than talk about them.
That undoubtedly means the Irish Catholic Church will be smaller, but it may be, in a very different way, stronger. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Deborah Potter in Dublin.
We have a story today from Fred de Sam Lazaro about a woman in Senegal in West Africa, a former Peace Corps volunteer, who is helping Senegalese women abandon the painful, deeply traditional custom of female circumcision. The World Health Organization says 3 million girls a year are cut in this way, But Molly Melching and other aid workers have discovered how to persuade whole communities to give up their ancient practice.
In recent years, thousands of rural communities in Senegal have held extraordinary public rallies they call declarations, and they've declared an end to a deeply rooted practice, one rarely discussed in public, one commonly known as female circumcision.
Never in my wildest dreams could I have imagined that I would be sitting here years later saying that 4,792 communities in Senegal had abandoned. In the beginning, it was just unthought of, unbelievable, because it was so taboo.
Molly Melching founded a group called Tostan, Breakthrough in the local Wolof language, in the early 90s. She had modest goals to educate people about health and human rights, especially in rural areas and in local languages. The Illinois native is fluent in the ways of Senegal, but she keeps a low profile in the work of Tostan. Tostan's work often begins with an icebreaker, like an old movie. Many in the audience have never watched a film. To overcome the language barrier, the selection is a Buster Keaton silent movie classic from 1923. And it's a hit. A more serious film followed on vegetable gardening. It's all part of seminars on nutrition, health, basic human rights, and other issues in groups, songs, dances, and drama.
She needs to be cut. All girls need that.
It's proven to be one of the most promising attempts in history to wipe out what Melching calls female genital cutting, a practice that dates back 2,000 years.
Each year, the World Health Organization says up to 3 million girls in Africa are subjected to genital mutilation, and up to 140 million women live with its consequences.
You can't have a recognized marriage if she's not cut.
That cut is a painful rite of passage for girls across a wide swath of predominantly Islamic, African, and Middle Eastern countries. However, the practice goes back hundreds of years before Islam or Christianity, and it's also practiced in both faiths and religions native to this region. It's thought to have originated in the harems of ancient rulers as a means of controlling women's fidelity or as a sign of chastity among those who aspired to be consorts.
Those who were in the rest of society could move up, and you could marry someone who was more prestigious or had more money, more status, if you underwent this practice, because it was a sign of good reputation. And as the years went on, I mean, 2,200 years, it became very much a part of what was considered criteria for good marriage.
Melching came to this West African nation as a student in the 1970s and later as a Peace Corps volunteer. She stayed on to work on improving health education, which she found sorely lacking.
When you see a friend that you have known for several months and you've gone to her house for lunch, and then she tells you her child has some problem, that it's someone who's cast an evil spell on the child, the baby, and that she's going to take them to a religious leader to get the spell taken off. And you don't know what to say. And it turns out the baby was dehydrated.
But from the health education, women began to understand infection. And Melching says they began to connect the dots.
So suddenly, as they started learning the germ transmission and the consequences of FGC and how these infections occur and why they had more problems in childbirth than other women who have not been cut, they started saying, wait a minute.
People used to be afraid to talk about this before. Not anymore.
But how did women in conservative, patriarchal societies become able to speak out, especially on a sensitive sexual topic? Melching says it's because Tostan involves men and religious leaders who've confirmed that cutting is not required.
We share our modules with the religious leaders so that they see that everything that we do is for the well-being of the community, the health, and all these things are things that Islam espouses. And so they're very happy in general. But first of all, they're happy because we start with them. We respect them.
And that respect also carries over in the group's message on genital cutting.
Tostein found that using approaches that shame or blame people really was just the opposite of what would work in changing social norms. When you say to someone, we know you love your daughter, and you're doing things because you love your daughter, but let's look at this and let's try to understand together exactly what are the consequences of this practice, but you are the ones that will have to make the decision, then suddenly people are willing to listen. They don't get defensive.
It's far more effective than the approach of many aid groups, religious, government, and private, says Princeton University professor Jerry Mackey.
Not hectoring and preaching, but having pro and con discussions. When we think of an ideal way of making a change, we'd say it's democratic. We all get together and talk it over and decide what the best thing is to do. Whereas some development approaches would say, force them to do it, pay them to do it, trick them into doing it.
Tostan's volunteers and staff who conducted seminars all hail from the local communities. Often they are leaders and elders, speaking from personal experience or anecdotes. Jare Ba used to make a living as a female circumciser.
I was part of this process. I felt bad. This is not right. But I didn't know anything at the time. I had no learning.
Others have painful, vivid memories. Ibrahim Sankare was very close to an older sister growing up. He walked into her room one evening.
I saw her lying in a pool of blood. I thought someone had really hurt her. I screamed. My father explained to me. Since then, even now, I get goosebumps thinking about it.
It was very painful. I will never. You ask me if I can forget it, I will never forget the pain. So painful.
Mariam Bemba is a longtime campaigner against genital cutting, and she spared her 10-year-old daughter the trauma. Yet before she became involved with Tostan and early in her marriage, she was determined to keep up the tradition. Even her own husband was opposed to genital cutting.
She insisted that she had to do it. There were so many problems if you didn't do it. If you cooked meals, no one would eat your food. It's because we didn't know. People told us that it was our religion. If you don't do it, you'll be going against your religion. All this is false. But I alone can't do this in the village.
They say Tostan was able to ensure they were not alone, that communities in which they intermarried were also thinking alike, that their daughters would still be marriageable. The large declaration ceremonies have been critical.
One part of bringing about a change like this is to get everyone to change at once, what we call coordinated abandonment. Everyone has to see that everyone else sees that everyone is changing.
Genital cutting is not the only tradition they want to change. Many communities have vowed to end the frequent practice of allowing older men to marry adolescent girls, acknowledging both the health risks and the girls' human rights. Molly Melching says there's plenty of historical precedent for abrupt changes in social norms and attitudes. She sees a very current example every time she comes home. That's in American views about smoking.
People were smoking and nobody said anything about it much through the 50s, the 60s, even the 70s. And as people became more and more aware of the harm that it causes, more and more people, there was a critical mass of people who started really protesting. It was amazing for me, coming from Senegal to the United States, to see how quickly things turned around.
Tostan's efforts have now expanded to 14 other African nations. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred de Sam Lazaro in Kaolack, Senegal.
In other news, the Church of England said this week it may sell its $6 million share in Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation unless the organization conducts a full and open inquiry into the recent phone hacking scandal. Church leaders called the actions of Murdoch's British tabloid, The News of the World, utterly reprehensible and unethical. And finally, during its coverage of last month's U.S. Open golf tournament, NBC ran a montage that included the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, most of it. It left out the words, "under God, indivisible." Members of Congress, among others, complained, and NBC this week formally apologized. It said there was nothing ideological about the omission and that the employees involved have been reprimanded. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, find us on YouTube, and watch us anytime, anywhere on smartphones and iPhones. There's also much more on our website. You can comment on all our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the Liturgy of Lament for the victims of sex abuse and their families at Dublin's Pro Cathedral.